This year is the 50th anniversary of the first general-purpose computer, ENIAC, which was designed at the University of Pennsylvania. As part of the university's year-long celebration, the university library sponsored a panel discussion about the Internet. We're about to hear an excerpt of the panel, which I moderated. We'll be hearing from four people. James Glick writes about technology and the future in his New York Times Sunday Magazine column, Fast Forward. Sherry Turkle is an MIT sociology professor who studies how people communicate online and how they use their invisibility to create new names, new identities, and even change gender. Her latest book is Life on the Screen. Paul Ginsberg is a theoretical physicist at Los Alamos who founded an online physics journal that has become a global database. Paul Evan Peters was the founding director of the Coalition for Networked Information, which helps libraries and educational institutions take advantage of the net. Sadly, he died suddenly last month, just a few days after the panel. The first question, which was asked by a member of the audience, concerned the social implications of anonymity online. Is it risky when people log on with false identities? Journalist James Glick, who once ran an internet access service, spoke first.
I had to make a real-world decision about this issue, or a virtual-world decision about this issue. And Pipeline was a small service in early days, and it was mine, and I felt able to make a dictatorial decision, which was that we required our users to use their real names.
Why?
Because I believed, as I suspect the questioner believes, that using your real names is a tremendous encourager of civil behavior, that some of the, well, all of the ugliest, most vicious, most harassing, most undesirable behavior that I saw online was done behind the mask of anonymity. Sherry's nodding, I'm really going to be interested to hear.
She's
going to
be logging on as a man
this.
Later tonight,
because
though.
she's participated. That's right. Sherry has participated in a lot of social activity online that is greased by anonymity, that depends on anonymity. This policy of ours was very unpopular with a certain segment of our user base, and I was under a lot of heat. There were people who really hated me for enforcing this because they wanted to participate in some of these things, and in particular, there were a number of women who felt that I was anti-woman because they argued that they could not participate comfortably in certain live discussion settings without disguising their identity, either disguising their gender or not, but at least giving themselves some protection. They were afraid that people would be able to find out their phone numbers and harass them in real life. I felt that there was a sort of catch-22 here, that the nasty behavior they were trying to protect themselves from existed because of anonymity, and that letting them be anonymous too was not a very good solution to the problem, that if there are a lot of people online who tend to harass women in particular, it's not really a good solution to that to let women pretend that they're not women, at least not a good long-term social solution. But as I say, I was unpopular, and I'm open to at least hearing other points of view.
Sherry, what are your thoughts on that?
I think that the web, the internet, is not a place. You know, it isn't the web, capital T, capital W, or the internet, you know, capital T, capital I. It is many, many different cultures and subcultures and places and subplaces. Just like, you know, there are bars that I wouldn't go into, and there are bars that I would feel comfortable having a drink with a friend. There are places on the internet where I wouldn't go and places I would go. There are places that can have different rules, I think, for how they want to handle this matter. I think there should be places on the internet, as Pipeline was, where, you know, the deal is you use your name. And there should be places, I think, where consenting adults, and I think that is an issue about the mm-hmm. whole adults-children thing, which we're not discussing for a moment, but where hopefully consenting adults can go on and use other names. But the key is that the rules of the game are agreed to in advance by the participants in that particular virtual culture. So I'd like to see us look forward to an internet where there are many different virtual cultures and subcultures which have their rules and where people consent to be a part of them.
Paul Peters, you had some thoughts.
Oh, just to follow up on Sherry's point, the area in which anonymity is used most often, I think, for productive purposes is with children's use of the internet. And what I wanted to speak up to is in states like Texas and Michigan, both states which have very high-profile multicultural education objectives at the elementary and secondary level, they have found that when they gather together students for science fairs or other annual sorts of events, that these children have built up intellectual and other important relationships without importing into cyberspace some of the attributes pro and con of physical space. If your name is Martinez or your name is Sherry, you import into cyberspace some things that can work against some very important educational objectives. And so you bring these children together and they have these, I didn't know you were disabled, or I didn't know you were X, I didn't know you were Y, because we were working on the science fair project and you were the one I connected with. So I'm just saying, again, to pick up on Sherry's point and to make a point that I will always make, that this is a very complex environment, and providing people with freedom of choice as regards how they want to commune in this environment is the guiding principle, not whether anonymity is pro or con, because you can find positive cases on both sides of that question.
Sherry, go ahead.
There's a related issue. I once went on to one of these multi-user domains and found a character there called Dr. Sherry. This wasn't an issue of anonymity. It was an issue of, you know, what did it mean that someone, this Dr. Sherry had created an office where she was interviewing people about their life in cyberspace and conducting psychological profiles. And after weeks of being kidded by colleagues, you know, was it as good for you as it was for me last night, Dr. Sherry, about, you know, what was Dr. Sherry doing in this space, I became increasingly perturbed until a colleague asked me, well, you know, what makes you think that Dr. Sherry isn't a little artificial intelligence program that just knows how to talk to people, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
Which was very possible because this Dr. Sherry was always there. You know, 24 hours a day, Dr. Sherry was in her office. And it turned out it was three undergraduates who were writing a thesis on the psychology of cyberspace, Dr. Sherry was always there, because they were kind of sharing the identity. But I think that whole experience of kind of confronting your double, and it could be a cyborg confronting your double, and you don't know if it's a, what are my rights over my name and over my persona, you know, coming to see you yourself as something of a persona in this world, that's another aspect of what can happen in cyberspace that doesn't have to do with your being anonymous, but how do you protect yourself against...
Did you raise any objections?
Well, no, I had this kind of Star Trek, first directive notion of doing, of not interfering with the civilizations that I so I had a kind of anthropologist's reticence. But I was glad when kind of the Dr. Sherry story got out and people knew that it wasn't me, yeah.
Let the natives develop at their own pace, eh?
Yes, let the natives develop at their own pace.
What about nuke them into the Stone Age? It's the only way to be sure. It's very interesting here is because there's a science fiction story by Werner Vinge, you know, from 20 years ago called True Names, in which he was a mathematician. He writes in the preface to this, that he was logged on sometime in the late 60s, and he received, you know, some send message, and he couldn't tell what it was from, and he just realized that the key in the future would be, you know, whether or not you could find out somebody's true identity. And he wrote this story, and it was exactly what Sherry is describing, of people wandering through this sort of Dungeons and Dragons type environment, and they would encounter these personality simulators, and, you know, you could sometimes tell whether it was a real person or not, but, you know, I have that problem in the real world anyway. And the thing that's striking to me, though, is that I'm, you know, very much in line with Jim on this, that, you know, but only because I'm coming from this academic community, that it would never even occur to me that there would be an advantage to posing as somebody else. I would just take it for granted. Yeah, you use your, you know, modulo these issues of gender bias, but you use your real name, your real, if you, it's sort of, an inducement to antisocial behavior to allow people to masquerade in some cases. And I'm not really, I'm curious to know whether that will remain an issue or whether it'll just go away.
We're listening to a panel discussion about the internet recorded at the University of Pennsylvania. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back to a panel discussion on the internet recorded last month at the University of Pennsylvania. The panelists are journalist and author James Glick, sociologist and author Sherry Turkle, physicist Paul Ginsbarg, who founded an online physics journal, and Paul Evan Peters, who was the founding director of the Coalition for Networked Information.
I'd like each of you to tell us what you'd most like to be able to get from the internet that you can't quite get now, but you think you might be able to get really soon. Some use that you could put it to, or access that you could have, information that you could get.
Oh, I'd love to have as easy voice access to the people on the internet as I have text access. So most of the time when I think about that, I think of what the world would be like if I could set up a video conference as quickly as I can set up a website, or even better, an FTP server to talk tech for a minute. And I think those capabilities are well targeted and ahead of us, that the threshold for doing non-text encounters on the internet would get as low as the current threshold for text encounters, which is pretty low.
Well, I'd like us to move beyond the stage of being excited by the global possibilities of the internet, like, oh my God, there's somebody in Australia who has my identical stamp collection. You know, that kind of thrill of kind of this global sense of connection, to more wiring up of our local communities. I'd like to see, I live in a local community in Boston that's less of a community or a neighborhood than kind of a physical place. I live in Back Bay, and it doesn't have a community center particularly. It has lots of hotels and Starbucks, and it doesn't have a Cheers. And I'd like to have that neighborhood online so that I, who have a five-year-old girl, could sort of know who else in that neighborhood has children of her age, and, you know, kind of sort, you know, insofar as they wanted to identify themselves, talk about their interests. In other words, really moving away from global models to the creating of a virtual communities of the physical communities that we live in. You know, stopping, you know, ending the talk about splitting the virtual and the real, and start to talk about splitting the virtual and the physical to make a new real that integrates our local physical presences with our virtual presences. So I'd like to see much more local uses of the net. Jim?
I think a huge barrier that has not yet fallen is a barrier that stands between us and public information. Now, I've been talking about protecting information that belongs to me, but as citizens, we have all paid for a massive amount of extremely valuable information that is in the possession of the government. Everything from maps to photos from outer space to the full database of patents throughout history, to financial filings before the Securities and Exchange Commission, to birth certificate records at your local city hall, to live proceedings from city council meetings. All of this stuff exists in some form or other, often in computer forms. Very little of it is available now online. And I guess I want to reverse now everything I said about copyright. There are a lot of cases where this material is protected by private companies who have cataloged it, or by government agencies who haven't got a small budget to put it online. There's a lot of valuable stuff there. It belongs to us. It could grease the wheels of knowledge if this material was made available.
What are the odds of that?
Oh, 100%. But you didn't give me an end date.
Yeah, when do you think it would happen?
It is starting to happen. And it will be happening at an accelerating pace over the next decade, I would guess. Because the old stuff will be the hardest of all. Stuff that's not in computers and is on paper will take longest, of course.
Yeah, Paul, what would you like to say?
Yeah, just reiterating the different types of information that we deal with, and where Jim himself, as both consumer and producer, can make that. I'm very much in agreement with this notion of localization. I've always been vexed by the fact that I can, you know, I have an internet node right in my home, and I can, you know, get up in the morning, have my coffee, find out what physics seminars are going on in Geneva, but, you know, I can't find out what the road construction is about at the base of my driveway. And there is a lot of public information, communication with public officials, which people would prefer to suppress. It's not in their interest to get a lot of public input on that. And so the localized information, I think, it will also come. Again, this decade, you know, sort of time frame is most likely. The other thing I'd like to see is something that is not as popular, but something that people would understand, which is an increased stratification to mirror the kind of isolation we get for social and geographic reasons. You know, for example, we're sitting in this auditorium. We don't have to worry about disruptions from people on the street, people from the exterior. We can have in our universities, in our research libraries, seminars, and not have to worry about it. And right now there's a misperception that, you know, just as everything on the internet should be free, everything on the internet should be wide open, and anything anybody can do what they like with it. It's connected to this notion of hacking, breaking into computers. Somebody who would never dream of walking up to your house and throwing a brick through your window would somehow regard it as fun and nothing wrong with it to try to, you know, break into your computer and disrupt it, cause it to reboot itself. And so there's a certain mentality, a certain social decorum that's very well understood in the physical real world that hasn't yet made its way to the internet. And I would like to see that kind of social, and this sounds like a very unpopular notion, but ultimately we realize that a lot of these social and academic constructs are there for a very good reason, and it's just a misconception that the internet should break all of those down and that would be a positive development.
The panel discussion on the internet featured James Glick, Sherry Turkle, Paul Ginsbarg, and Paul Evan Peters. Sadly, Peters died several days after the panel was recorded last month. The panel was held at the Van Pelt Dietrich Library of the University of Pennsylvania as part of their 50th anniversary celebration of ENIAC, the first computer, which was created at Penn. Our thanks to the university and the library.